And then what happens is we get busy. All of these things, being relevant and being innovative is exhausting. It takes an unbelievable amount of energy and an unbelievable amount of time.
Welcome to Hope Renewed, helping you find new hope when ministry leaves you hopeless. The Hope Renewed podcast is brought to you by BIR Ministries. Here are your hosts, Tom Jameson and Sean Nemechek.
Well, we are excited today to have Carl Vaders back with us. Carl, welcome to Hope Renewed.
Thank you. It's good to be back with you guys. Yeah, it seems like we do this a lot.
I think this is number three. We were just saying you're ascending the ranks of guest on Hope Renewed, but it's a joy to see you again. And great, very excited to share about this new venture that you have undergone. And today, I think, is actually an important day. Yes, Sean?
Yeah, this is really cool. Your book's just come out recently. This new book is called Desizing the Church. So you are kind of the big guy who loves small churches, but this one's different, isn't it? This isn't just for small churches. So before we talk about what the book's about, I'm just curious, what led you to write this book?
As you say, I've been writing really for small church pastors and leaders for the last 11 years now. I've written four books on that. So my previous four books were really for the small church, for small church leaders to help with that, to encourage and resource them. But a couple of years ago, I was actually on a podcast, and I was one of two guests, and the other guest was Gary McIntosh, who is a big church growth proponent and is the biographer of Donald McGavran, who is the founder of the church growth movement. And in talking through some of the founding of the church growth movement, McIntosh told me and the host that, in fact, McGavran's idea for the church growth movement was not at all what it turned out to be, and that, in fact, he tried to restrict his classes and not allow American pastors in his classes because he was suspicious about what Americans would do with his principles if we ever got a hold of them. And I thought, okay, I need to know more about this. So I got a hold of that biography and I did some further research and I found out, wow, okay, the obsession that we have with bigness came from places that I was unaware of. And in fact, I was kind of blaming McGavran for things that weren't his fault, but that in fact he saw some problems with. So that's where the genesis of it began. It was really, where did this obsession with bigness come from? And who is this McGavran guy that I thought I knew about, but really didn't know about?
So the title of the book is Desizing the Church, How Church Growth Became a Science, Then an Obsession, and What's Next. I love that title. Where did you get the word desizing from? I've never heard that word before.
Yeah, I just made it up. It's true. I mean, for my first book, The Grasshopper Myth, I just made up the term. I didn't make up either of those words, but I put them together so I made up the term grasshopper myth. And I made up the word desizing. And it was trying to think of how to call this thing that I was talking about. And I'm not interested in downsizing because I don't think small is better than big. And it's not right sizing because I don't think there's any universal right size for a church to be. But I did want to come up with a term that encapsulated in the shortest way possible the idea that our obsession with size is dangerous and our obsession with getting bigger is problematic. And I couldn't come up with a word that shortened that down little term, so I just made one up, and desizing was the term. So desizing is the idea that we need to remove size as the primary determiner for whether or not a church is healthy.
And you mentioned that maybe your first thought was that was coming out of a philosophy or theology somewhere, but I mean, where really did that catch a lot of energy, this idea that bigger is better and the church, you know, can only assess its health by the size of the people in the pews or the budget?
Yeah, this took some work because, you know, starting with that cue that Dr. McIntosh gave me about looking into McGavran, I looked into Donald McGavran, who is universally considered to be the founder of the church growth movement. His book, The Bridges of God, which came out in the 1960s, is the spark point for that. He literally coined the term church growth, and a lot of the language and a lot of the thought that we use in church growth movement came from him. But I started thinking, okay, why was he so concerned with what American pastors would do with it? And so I started doing some research into American history. So in the book, I've got two full chapters, two, maybe three, on American history and how some of America's best ideas have some unintended negative consequences. And by America's best ideas, I mean literally our best ideas, like the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights to the Constitution of the United States, one of the best ideas ever written in the English language, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and so on. But what I discovered was, of course, the people who penned those amazing documents were coming from European countries, and they were coming for freedom of religion. But what I didn't realize was that in the countries that they came from, not only was there a church state, but because there's a church state, the church collected the state collected not just taxes from the people, but the state collected tithes from the people in their taxes, and then distributed those tithes to the approved churches. And in fact, there are still a couple European countries that do that today.
Wow.
Come to America and there's no state church anymore, but that means there's no tax collected tithes either, which means every church now can believe what you want, but in order to finance your church, you have to collect offerings. And you've got a bunch of people who came from Europe who weren't used to the idea of giving regularly to their church because I've already paid that through my taxes. They had to convince people that they have to give now in the offering, and the larger a group you got and the more dynamic you could preach, the more money you could get out of people, the bigger you could build your church. And so the entrepreneurial pastor was born in America. It really didn't exist before the First Amendment. So again, some of our greatest ideas, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, is right up there among the best ideas humans have ever had. But that's the negative consequence, was now you've got the entrepreneurial thing going that becomes the dominant way now that churches grow in America. And that's a really, really shortened version of it.
Yeah. That was my favorite part of this book, I think. The whole book is great. I've been giving it away and telling people, you got to get this book. I think it's really, really important. But the section on the history of growth and specifically the different great awakenings, the revivals that have happened, and how they've affected the church, that was fascinating. Now, you mention in this book three great awakenings, and not everybody is aware of all three. Could you just briefly run down what those three great awakenings are what's the overall impact they've had on the church?
Yeah. Well, the first great awakening would be the Wesleys and Wycliffe back in that era. And by the way, before I even get into the great awakenings, we've got this picture in our head as Americans that somehow America used to be this godly place and that just become more and more ungodly decade after decade. Part of what I show in the book was that we've swung up and down radically, and that in fact today we are actually much better than we were in previous times in our history. Like, there's a reason the Wild West was called wild. It wasn't because everybody was going to church every Sunday, right? You know, and in 1776, church attendance was 17%.
Wow.
Like, everybody's gotten upset recently because the most recent, Gallup poll shows church attendance at under 50, church membership at under 50%. And the headline was, for the first time ever. No, for the first time since they've been keeping track of it in the last 80 years. But it's not by far the lowest ever. So anyway, there was a reason we needed these great awakenings, was because we were an ungodly country for huge segments of our time. So the first great awakening, you've got Whitfield and you've got Wesley and others like that. Second great awakening, you've got folks like Moody, And I'm trying to remember offhand. Oh no, you've got several who aren't as well known, but it really caps off with Finney.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Charles Finney was the first evangelist in America who didn't emphasize, like Wesley and Whitfield did, this. He did emphasize conversion, but he codified it. He said, hey, here are ways you can duplicate the way I did things and do it the way I did it and have that come along. And so Finney was really the first one who kind of codified revivalism and wrote it down and said, here are ways that you can duplicate what I did. And that was a new way of looking at things, that we're not just waiting for God to show up, but we figured out ways to program this into the process here. And then the third Great Awakening, which a lot of historians don't even recognize as a Great Awakening, which you implied in your question, Sean, was when you've got folks like Amy Semple McPherson and D.L. Moody and Spurgeon and so on. And that gave birth to things like the Pentecostal movement, and even gave birth to the Unitarians and the Mormons. And during that whole era was when kind of that all kind of, actually that was more Second Great Awakening, the Mormons. But you've got this this period of time. And I think the main reason that this doesn't necessarily get called a Third Great Awakening is because the other ones kind of ebbed and then flowed, and then, or flowed and then ebbed, flowed and then ebbed. And this one never really ebbed. This is the one that we've been building upon ever since. So you've still got Angelus Temple. You've still got Moody Tabernacle. You've still got these places that are still operating today and gathering large groups of people into these buildings. And we're still building on the principles of the people that came along in the Third Great Awakening.
So connected to these Great Awakenings is the idea of the celebrity pastor. I mean, you just rattled off a bunch of names that they were covered in the newspapers. They were reprinted like crazy. Everybody seemed to know who they are, like D.L. Moody, Finney, Spurgeon, and so many others. So I'm curious, just to get your take on how the idea of celebrity and celebrity culture hurts the church, and maybe even hurts pastors.
Yeah, this is obvious. This is one of the real primary premises of the book, is that we have the entrepreneurial approach to ministry. Almost of necessity creates a celebrity culture, because the pastor who can draw the biggest crowd because they have the most charismatic preaching style or whatever is the one that's going to build the biggest church. And then we reverse engineer that by going, well, if you build the biggest church, you must be doing this the best. And then what happens is we end up overlooking other things because, well, they must be doing something right if they're drawing such a big crowd, for example. Just a week or so ago, yet another documentary about church abuse came out, this one by Matt Redman called Let There Be Light. He put it on YouTube. It's only half an hour long, about some of the abuse that he suffered in Soul Survivor when he was a teen and in his early 20s, and how others were abused by the same person during that segment of time. And in that half an hour, I actually paused it partway through and rewound it because they kept referencing, but it was so big and there were so many people coming to Jesus and there were so many youth gathered, we just couldn't question it, because 11 times in half an hour, there were references to, we couldn't challenge it because the numbers were so strong. 11 times in half an hour. Yeah. So what happens is, because there's this numerical success, it then provides cover. For all kinds of abuse and for all kinds of other distresses. And even if there's not direct abuse, even if the leader who is charismatic and entrepreneurial and drawing a crowd, even if they're not a bad person and even if they're not abusing anybody, the pace of keeping that up becomes so overwhelming that, well, they end up needing people like you, Sean, right? And your book. Because burnout becomes such a massive thing because we're being driven to keep these numbers up. So there's all kinds of dangers that come as a result of this overwhelming pursuit of numbers, including a covering for all kinds of sin and a burnout culture that we actually want to reward people for.
So how do you begin to kind of separate what's legitimate in church growth like that and what's not?
It's hard because the two are interwoven so much. There are some very, very healthy, very, very large churches, and there are some very healthy church movements that have grown at rapid paces. Mm-hmm. So the rapid pace and the big size is neither a determiner of health nor of ill health. Mm-hmm. So we've got to look beneath the surface of that. And the two chapters in my book where I make that turn, and these are the two hooks that I hang my answer on, the two chapters are Integrity is the New Competence and Discipleship Fixes Everything. Mm-hmm. And those are two very, I've worked very hard on coming up, quite frankly, with snappy, memorable titles for those chapters because the objects are important enough that I want them to be memorable. So, mm-hmm. you know, first of all, Integrity is the New Competence. Are people operating with integrity? We are not losing people. People are not becoming de-churched today. They are not deconstructing their faith today because we're not getting our technique right. But they are leaving because we have not been trustworthy and we are not people of integrity. So integrity has to be beneath everything. So the first question should not be, can they get the numbers up? First question should be, have they displayed a lifetime of character and are they people of integrity? And is that the general word on the street about this minister and their ministry? That doesn't mean that one or two negative moments are going to disqualify somebody, because sometimes that can be somebody who's got an axe to grind, or it can be simply a mistake that they've repented of and moved forward on. But that ought to be what they're known for. They ought to be known as people of integrity and character first, and getting the numbers up should be a distant second to that. And then secondly, are we discipling people? Discipleship fixes everything. And we need to be discipling people. That is the primary call. You know, I've got this imaginary conversation that goes on in my head on a regular basis when I talk about this. I imagine Jesus in heaven looking at us through scripture and going, okay, I'm going to build my church, okay? You guys go make disciples. And we look back at Jesus and go, got it. We're going to go build the church. And you go, no. You guys, I'm going to build the church. You guys make disciples. Got it. We'll go build your church. No. Right? Because that's what we do. We're constantly going out there trying to build his church. And Jesus said, no, I will take care of that. Mm. You make disciples. Got it. Church growth. Now. Right? So that's the key. We need to be people of integrity and we need to be people of discipleship. Yeah. And there will be times in both of those areas. Most of the time, you can see a church grow and be a person of integrity. And most of the time, discipleship will in fact lead to numerical growth. But there will be times in which you have to choose between, am I going to be a discipleship church or are we going to be a numerically growing church? And there will be times when those two decisions diverge and you need to pre-decide that you're going to go with discipleship rather than the numerical growth. And even more so with integrity. There will be times when numerical growth asks you to compromise your integrity. And we need to pre-decide that when that choice comes, I will always choose for integrity first.
I feel like we should just pause there and, you know, just
repent.
Have a Eli moment, you know. It's so good.
But integrity and discipleship aren't necessarily real glamorous, are they? No. Nor are they quick fixes. And yet there is that draw to be relevant, to be attractive in a culture that just demands it so much. As you think about pastors' voices and pastors wanting to have a relevant voice and to be heard, because integrity is not a voice that a lot of people necessarily want to listen to, they strive to have their voice, you know, make their voice known. What's the danger of a pastor seeking, especially like an online presence where there are so many voices, The danger of pastors chasing kind of an online platform to be relevant, to make themselves known.
Yeah, I'm when I first started this ministry, I've been doing this, you know, ministry to small churches for 11 years. And for the first 5, 6, 7 years, I used the words relevant and innovative in the taglines for what I did. I don't use them anymore. There's nothing wrong with being relevant. There's nothing wrong with being innovative. But we have chased innovation and relevancy to death. And we are now, and anytime you elevate anything other than integrity and character as your primary goal, you will come to the point where you're asked to compromise your integrity or your character. And then what happens is we get busy. All of these things, being relevant and being innovative is exhausting. It takes an unbelievable amount of energy and an unbelievable amount of time. Now, some people seem to come by it more naturally, and they just kind of always seem to be the cool guy in the room. And if you happen to be that and you come by it naturally, God bless you. I'll take that for what it is. But the amount of energy that it takes to do that, I think, creates, again, what you talk about so well, this place of burnout where I just don't have room. I don't have space in my life to slow down. As you mentioned earlier, these things we're talking about, integrity and discipleship, take time. You can't get there fast. You have to have a lot of downtime, a lot of pondering time, a lot of time in the Word, a lot of time with God's people. There's a reason why my podcast is called The Church Lobby, because that's where most of the best ministry in church is done, not from the platform, but in the lobby. And church lobby time is slow, it's ponderous, it's difficult, it's relational, it's not glamorous or sexy, but that's where we need to be investing more of our time. And the bigger you get, the less time you're able to spend in a church lobby. I understand why the pastor of a church of thousands doesn't spend their time in the church lobby, because it's exhausting, because all they're doing is taking selfies. There's no real ministry happening in the church lobby when you're talking to thousands of people. I was just recently, I almost never speak to large crowds, but just last month I had the opportunity in Germany, of all places, to speak to 7,000 church leaders at once. I've never had that bigger crowd. I mean, bigger than my biggest crowd by many, many, many times. And it was just fascinating for me, as the guy who's usually in the room with 70 people, not 7,000 people, to have the experience of walking through the lobby after that. Or when I'm in my usual conference with 70 or 100 or even 200 pastors at the most, usually afterwards, we have all kinds of conversations over lunch and in the lobby, and we hang out and they come up to me and there's this comfort level. But all of a sudden, I'm the guy that everybody's like, oh, that's him over there. Can I get a selfie with you? Oh, would you sign a book? And it's like, none of that was appealing to me. I get why there is an appeal to that. Mm-hmm. But to me, it was just exhausting more than anything else. Like, I want to sit down and have a conversation with fellow pastors and church leaders as two human beings who can sit down and, what is God doing in your life? And what is God doing in my life? And how can we help each other? And just constantly taking selfies. And if you're in that environment constantly, I don't know how you maintain a healthy emotional or spiritual state.
You know, just as you're talking, I'm thinking about just Jesus in the Gospels. We often highlight the times where he's got the big crowds, you know, the feeding of the 5,000 and others. But there are several times where Jesus resisted celebrity.
Oh, yeah.
And you might even say he shrunk the crowd intentionally by some of the things he said. So how do you see this focus on integrity and discipleship is really being just developing the character of Jesus in a pastor?
Absolutely. This is, we're supposed to be striving to be like Jesus. We're supposed to be, as the Apostle Paul said, follow my example as I follow the example of Christ, right? Which means if he stops following the example of Christ, then we should stop following his example. You're only supposed to follow the leader to the degree that they are following the example of Christ. That's the whole point. That's what discipleship is. You know, we've talked about discipleship. Let's define it. Discipleship is living the character of Christ among other people who then live the character of Christ. Mm-hmm. That's the whole point of it. And we often miss that when we are emphasizing all of these other things, but it's supposed to be becoming more like Christ and helping others to become more like Christ. Mm-hmm. And to any degree that we lose sight of that, then we lose sight of the one assignment Jesus gave us, which was to make disciples. We're supposed to be seeing a Christ-like nature develop in ourselves and in the others who we spend time with. That's the entire thing. Hmm.
So I've talked with a lot of large church pastors who feel like their job has become maintaining momentum, you know, keeping the organization going and maybe growing, but at least maintaining. And it's exhausting to them. Now, I know you don't think large churches are necessarily bad, and I don't either. So what are some of the good things that large churches do, and how can they get away from that momentum grind?
Yeah, I've actually got a chapter in my book, What Church Growth Movement Got Right, and I'm going to look it up just simply because I got to remember what I wrote sometimes.
This is so refreshing to me.
I know, right? As a fellow author, you know, right? Yeah. You said this in your book. Can you walk us through those 4 points? I got to look those 4 points up first. I think there are some great things that big churches got really, really well, and that the church growth movement on its own did well. Just as with the First Amendment, some of our loftiest ideas have unintended negative consequences. So the church growth movement, which was by and large good, we're talking about some of its unintended negative consequences. But there are some things that it did really well. For instance, megachurch pastors tend to be extremely generous in sharing of information. They're not making any of their ideas proprietary, right? Mm-hmm. One of the reasons you can go to a conference and get all the latest ideas downloaded from any megachurch pastor or just listen to their podcast for free is because when they discover something that works, they want to tell everybody and they want everybody to use it as much as possible. So there's a great sharing of information and a generosity. Big churches, megachurches, and the church growth movement have really renewed the idea of looking outside the church walls, of being missional, of not just taking care of those inside the walls, but also reaching outside the walls. One of the things that I discovered in my research was churches that have been more innovative on their methods have actually, by and large, stayed more conservative on their biblical principles. We've got this slippery slope idea. Well, if we start, you know, dressing casually and bringing drums in and like singing louder songs, then the next thing you know, we're going to be denying the authority of Scripture. But in fact, research and my own anecdotal evidence shows that the churches that have really pushed innovation have usually been more conservative biblically. And if you're going to churches that have strayed into unbiblical practices, you will quite often, and in fact more often, find more traditional church garb and more traditional church language there. And I think that's partly because we're so passionate about reaching people for Jesus that we will change our methods in order to do so. Mm-hmm. So we've got to have this proper balance. This is not a diss of the big church, and it's not a diss of innovative methods, because there's some real positives to that. We just need to be aware of the downsides. Mm.
So I'm curious, Carl, how would you counsel a pastor to lead in desizing their church without desizing themselves out of a role?
That is an awesome question. Yes. And I think you're getting to the heart of the big concern for a whole lot of folks. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I talk to small church pastors who are at a smaller size, I'll say there's nothing wrong with being that size. And their answer is, yeah, except that I can't pay my bills. A very legitimate concern. I don't see that as a minor concern at all. Obviously, we want to be able to pay our bills. So how do we desize without desizing ourselves out of a job? That's a great way to phrase it. I we have to to use a metaphor, play the long game. There are going to be some immediate hits that we may take. But if you take a look around at the state of the American Evangelical Church today, there's nobody who is looking around and going, oh, we're awesome and we're just getting better. I don't know that the news is quite as dire as some of our worst predictions, but nobody's looking around going, we are in great shape and things are getting better. We are obviously off from our peak and are heading in a wrong direction. And so we've got to turn that around. So if we don't restore our integrity, and if we don't double down on the importance of discipleship, we're going to lose way more in the long term than any short-term losses that we might experience by saying, okay, we've got to do things with integrity and we've got to do things with discipleship, even if it means some short-term losses. Mm-hmm. And that's, I don't know if somebody sociologically has defined this, but for me, the definition of maturity for an individual or for an organization is that we're willing to deny ourselves short-term aims in order to have long-term gains.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we are in the American church. We've got to say we may experience some short-term losses, but let's take the short-term losses intentionally so that we can have some long-term gains in our integrity and discipleship.
Carl, toward the end of the book, you have a section on desizing priorities, and you know, just some things that we need to think about. Can I throw a couple of those at you and just have you give a quick response? So the first one is model faithfulness over performance. What's that sound like?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I have been. I talked earlier about the importance of the church lobby, right? Performance happens from the stage. Faithfulness happens in the church lobby. But the challenge was I was trained how to minister from this, from the platform. I wasn't really trained well how to minister well in the church lobby. I think we have assumed integrity. And so we've taught technique. And we can't assume integrity anymore. So we need to be teaching integrity with the same fervor that we have been teaching technique. Teaching faithfulness over performance. We've got a whole bunch of instruction about performance out there, but we don't have an awful lot of instruction about faithfulness. And when we do, not very many people show up. Right? That's So we've got but that's where if we want long-term sustainable ministry, faithfulness will get you there. Performance will bring you the crowd. Faithfulness will sustain you in the long run.
Yeah.
How about this one? Prioritize generosity over budgets.
Yeah, I love that one. It's been 20, 25 years ago that I started realizing, here in California at least, that my annual tithing sermon wasn't working anymore. You know, it used to be you remind people once a year they should be you know, tithing, and they go, oh, okay, that's right, I'll re-up. And we do the annual missions convention. Oh, yeah, we'll re-up to support our missionaries. And it stopped working. And I didn't know what to do for the longest time because that was what I was taught to do. You do your annual sermon, they're going to remember it. They'll give it because they're reminded of their duty biblically to give, whatever that might be. And then I started realizing that if you emphasize money, that's one thing. But if you emphasize generosity, that's a totally different thing. And if you're going to emphasize generosity, you need to live as a model of generosity. So this old model of we give out of duty is dead and dying. But the idea that we give because we want to live large, generous lives, that is something that is very appealing to today's generation. And when I say today's generation, I don't mean people born between this period of time and that period of time. I mean all the people alive on the earth today, this generation of all ages and from all eras. Today, the idea of being a generous person and being a trustworthy person, people are just as generous today as they've always been, but they're going to give to people who have been proven to be trustworthy and have been proven to be generous themselves, rather than simply, well, the Bible says I should, so I'm gonna. Giving out of generosity, giving to people who are generous and giving to people I can trust is not a less biblical reason to give than to give out of duty. So they've just gone from one biblical reason as their priority, duty, to a different biblical reason as their priority, people I trust and causes that matter to me.
That's a good insight. So one more, and this one, maybe we need to clarify, because I've heard a lot of church growth experts say healthy things grow, but you say prioritize health over growth.
Yeah.
What's that look like?
Yeah. The phrase all healthy things grow, in fact, I think in the book somewhere I say, if you're using phrases like all healthy things grow, you're actually behind the curve right now. Mm-hmm. I think that's an old idea and an old statement that we need to realize nobody's buying anymore. And what I mean by that is this. Yes, all healthy things do grow, but they grow in different ways, and it doesn't necessarily mean numerical growth. Secondly, when we say all healthy things grow, what we typically mean by that is, well, if the church is being a biblical church and is in fact a part of that being biblical means evangelism, means people are coming to Christ, then if people are coming to Christ, then my church will get bigger. Scientists call that a hypothesis. This is a reasonable idea that seems like it should work in the real world. But when scientists create a hypothesis, then they do this thing where they actually do the research to see if it can turn into a workable theory. We've assumed that the hypothesis is true, that all healthy things grow, by which we mean all healthy churches get larger numerically. That's what that really means,
yeah.
Right? So the hypothesis is, if you're a healthy church, you will get larger numerically. But if you take a look around the world today, you will find all kinds of healthy churches that are not growing numerically for all kinds of different reasons, including the church that I've been a part of in leadership for 31 years. We have a shoe size of about 150 to 200 that we kind of seem to land on, but we continue to grow. We continue to get healthier. We continue to send people off into ministry. And that's one of the reasons. And we continue to live in a transitional neighborhood where we lose 25 to 30% of our people every year, just simply because of physically moving out of the area. So the fact that we're maintaining our numbers means we're, you know, we're growing by 25 to 30% every year just to maintain these numbers, right? So you've got to take all of these other things into account if you're going to take a look at that. Do all healthy things grow? Yes. Does that mean that all healthy churches will increase numerically? No, that the research and the evidence simply doesn't back that up.
Yeah, we don't want to see kittens growing to the size of elephants. Healthy things grow to the size that they're supposed to be, and then they stop growing. And so that some of that principle applies to the church too. So Carl, yeah.
plus this relentless idea that we've got to get bigger next year is part of what's burning a lot of our pastors out. So let's get them off that treadmill.
Yeah, it's a reframing of understanding of what biblical growth or you know, theological growth looks like, as opposed to just logical growth.
Yeah.
So, Carl, what are your hopes for this book?
Wow, that's a question I hadn't even considered consciously. So let me dig into my psyche for that one. I would love if this helps, first of all, unburden a whole bunch of pastors from the need to stay on that relentless treadmill that says I have to get bigger every year or there's something wrong with me. So if I can unburden some pastors and church leaders, that's one thing. Secondly, if it can help to redirect the church leadership world towards discipleship and integrity rather than simply numerical increase, if I can be one of the voices that helps with that, I'll be grateful. And thirdly, if this book can be a part of the conversation that where we're taking our problems in the current evangelical church more seriously, where if my voice can be one of many voices that's saying, hey, wait a minute, let's not just try to fix this in the way we've been trying to fix this before by getting our numbers up, but let's put a pause on that for a moment and let's really reflect. And you said it almost jokingly earlier, Tom, but repent of the areas that we actually need to be repenting of and then recommit ourselves to discipleship and integrity. If my book can in any way be a part of a conversation that pushes us in that direction, I will be profoundly grateful for it.
Mm. Yeah, it'd be. Hey, Carl, I want to throw you a little bit of a curveball here. Just circling back, we talked to you about 6 or 8 months ago about sabbatical and the time mm-hmm. that you went through. You worked with Sean on your sabbatical. And I'm sure that time, if I remember correctly, impacted the writing of this book, the completion of this book. How so? How was your sabbatical experience impactful on your completion of this book and your hopes for it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I hadn't been thinking about that actively recently, but it was huge. One, it gave me just the amount of time. Some writers are able to sit down for an hour a day. In fact, some people instruct people that you want to write a book, sit down for an hour every morning, and at the end of a year, you'll have a book. Well, I wish. That's just not how my brain works. I can't turn it on, turn it off. I need long periods of time to ponder, to think, to research, to look like I'm doing nothing. I mean, my wife has had to learn along with me that my writing seasons look like long periods of laziness, where my brain is just pondering and thinking, and especially when I'm thinking about ideas in ways. Because this book, as we talked about with the history, has put things together in ways, all of this evidence was out there. Everybody who's read it has said, oh, all of these pieces make sense to me, but nobody put these pieces together this way before to help us understand it in this manner before. And you can't get there by jumping in and out of it. At least I can't get there by jumping in and out of it on a daily basis. So the sabbatical gave me a long time to really think and to ponder, to clear my mind, to clear my brain, and to clear my schedule of the constant busyness of answering emails every day, going to this conference here, preparing a sermon for Sunday, and just all the other things that are important, but that clutter my mind and my spirit that needed to be decluttered. So that was the biggest thing that it did. By the end of it, I was thinking very, very clearly. I had probably 4 or 5 book ideas that I kept going to my editor going, I want to do this instead. And he kept going, no, I like that original idea. I want you to write that thing. And it was just so hard. And until I finally got away and went, okay, now I can see a path through to the end of this. Mm. And that's what sabbatical did for me. Yeah.
Mm. Beautiful.
So we want to be sensitive of your time, and we just thank you so much for your generosity with us today. This has been really good. What's next for you?
Well, as of January, for the first time in over 40 years, I am no longer on staff at a church. My the current church that I currently serve, I was the lead pastor for 25 years, and then for the last 6 years, my youth pastor took over and is now the lead pastor and is doing an extraordinary job. I was his teaching pastor, but now this ministry to small churches has grown so large, and it is really where the Lord is leading us full time. So I'm doing this ministry full time. I'm currently writing book number 6. Book number 6 will be for a general Christian audience, not just for church leaders. And it's really going to be going further into this idea of integrity. And what does it mean for us to have integrity? It's the tentative title for it. And this is the first time I've said it publicly anywhere. So, imagine the little C copyright at the end of this. My tentative title is called The Priority Wheel. And I've come up with a simple way of showing biblical virtue, biblical values, how they are supported by biblical virtues, how our goals need to match those biblical values and virtues, and how everything else is a tool that we use towards goals that match what God values, that can only be lived through living the biblical virtues. So, and I put it into like a spiral wheel that I think will be a real guide for people to be able to point to and understand, oh, okay, I've been pursuing this, but in fact, that's a goal that I have, but it really isn't a biblical virtue. So it needs to be subservient to the biblical virtues. Yeah. It's a bit of a brain thinker again. So I'm going to be taking not an official sabbatical, but some serious time this summer to be able to process all of that in a way that comes across the way I want it to.
Great.
That's exciting. I'm really looking forward to that one.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, as always, we want to give you an opportunity just to speak directly to our listeners. What words of hope would you like to offer to the folks who are listening to us today?
I appreciate that opportunity. Yeah, speaking to primarily church leaders, whether you are in a large or a small church, if I can say anything to you today, it would be this. The size of your church is not the determiner of your value. Mm-hmm. Whether your church is big and you're determined to get bigger next year, whether you do or you do not get bigger next year is not a determiner of your value. If you are in a small church that is struggling, and just 2 days ago, I got emails from two different pastors, and I thought I got the same email twice because the wording was almost identical.
Wow.
Two pastors who are struggling, is this the time that I should be closing my church? So whether you're on the end of things where you're growing, or you're on the end of things where you're wondering if the church has reached the end of its life season and it's time to close it, neither of those is a determination of the value you have. You are valuable because you were made in the image of God. You have been blessed to have been called by God to to play a role in the salvation and the redemption of all creation back to the Creator. So don't ever forget that we have been called to the highest thing possible. And the only way we can do that is to be more like Jesus.
Thank you so much, Carl. It's been a pleasure talking with you today.
Yeah, thank you, Carl.
Thanks. You guys too, always. Appreciate it.
And we thank our guests for listening today. It is great to have you here. We invite you to check out our webpage, hoperenewedpodcast.com, to see this and many other podcasts, the other previous podcasts that we've had with Carl. And leave your comments there as well. We would love to hear that. And it is our prayer that the God of grace would indeed sustain you in who he has made you to be, beloved by him, and filled with the hope that only he can give.
Thank you for joining us on Hope Renewed. Please help us reach more pastors by sharing this episode with your friends. If you enjoy this podcast, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Google, or Spotify, or your favorite platform for receiving podcasts. Thank you. This means the world to us. The Hope Renewed podcast is brought to you by PIR Ministries. At PIR, we partner with God and the church in the work of pastoral renewal and restoration. Pastors, our goal is to help you cultivate new hope for healthy life and ministry. We do this by building relationships. We train both pastors and churches to promote a culture of ministry health. If you've experienced a forced exit from ministry, we provide a process of restoration for you and your family. We also have proven resources and tools to assist you in the challenges of ministry life. To contact us or to learn more about PIR, visit PIRministries.org.